WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. We'll begin today by following up on the politics of the new opening for Attorney General in New York State and the issue that Schneiderman's alleged behaviors shine an additional light on domestic violence, in his case, laced with racism and what one former dark-skinned girlfriend said he said to her. With us for this are Alexis Grinnell, back with us, co-founder of Pythia Public, a political and public affairs firm and a frequent contributor to the Daily News on both New York State politics and gender issues, and Liz Roberts, Deputy CEO at Safe Horizon, an organization offering support to victims of domestic violence. Full disclosure, after we booked them, we learned that Alexis's company has Safe Horizon as a client, but I don't think that changes anything we will hear from either of our guests. So Alexis, welcome back. Liz, welcome to WNYC today. Hi.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
Liz, let me start with you, because I wonder if the Schneiderman allegations have already resulted in any kind of increased outreach to Safe Horizon by domestic abuse victims seeking help.
What we often see with high-profile cases like this is that more survivors do reach out, and we'll be watching our hotline numbers over the next few days to look at the impact. What we also see is that survivors who are already connected with us feel stirred up by what they're seeing in the news, and so they may reach out with new questions or concerns or feelings about it.
I'll just give you kind of, you know, tabula rasa here to lay out any of the things in the New Yorker article that struck you as maybe the most important patterns of domestic violence that could use more public discussion.
So, you know, one of the questions I have been hearing since the article came out is this question about how can this happen to smart, accomplished, independent women like the two women who came forward and gave their names in the article. And I wanted to address that because I think it really speaks to some fundamental misconceptions in how we think about domestic violence in this country. So there are two problems with the question. One is that it very much blames the victims. It perpetuates the myth that domestic violence only happens to a certain kind of woman, and you can fill in the blanks about what kind of woman people think of, but they think of poverty, they think of race, they think of low self-esteem is one of the phrases I often hear. And when we go there, what we really do is divert attention from the more important question, which is why would somebody like Eric Schneiderman, according to these allegations, feel that he can behave in this way with such impunity and in such a persistent way over time? Why do we go there? Why do we want to ask that question? One reason, of course, is good old-fashioned sexism, our views about women and men and what their responsibilities are in relationships. But I think it also is self-protective. It allows many of us to distance ourselves from the problem, to believe that it can't happen to me, it can't happen to the people in my life, the people I care about. And it denies the truth that we hear about in our conversations with domestic violence survivors all day, every day, survivors who come from every possible walk of life, that it's the very dynamics of domestic violence, the range of abusive behavior, like the things we saw in the New Yorker article, the emotional abuse, the demeaning behavior, the sexual coercion and abuse, the physical violence, alternating with, you know, periods that are lovely, where you're really being charmed and courted, that range of abusive behavior in its very nature makes the victim feel trapped and confused and to really doubt their own perception of what's going on. So I wanted to put that out there because I think it's very much on people's minds.
And listeners, we will invite your phone calls on this. If you have been a victim of domestic abuse, or even if you're in an abusive relationship right now and want to ask Liz Roberts from Safe Horizon a question, obviously what anyone can do for you on the radio is limited, but it also can be helpful in some cases in conjunction with other things. Call and tell us your story from the past or your question about the present to help others prevent being abused or to help yourself today. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Or if you have any Attorney General politics questions for Alexis Grinnell, we'll get to that too in this conversation. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Alexis, anything you want to react to from Liz so far?
Well, Liz raises this great point about victim blaming, which is a very natural response. In fact, we see it, you know, today, for instance, in the New York Post editorial that claims a vast conspiracy that shielded Eric Schneiderman, whereas the New Yorker magazine certainly cites one unnamed blind source telling one of the victims not to come forward because Eric Schneiderman was too precious to lose. And that was absolutely disturbing to hear. I think it's worth discussing the fact of what the responsibility is for victims to, and the people they confide in, because the fact is, it cannot be the fault or responsibility of somebody who has experienced violence when their attacker violates someone else again. And it's a little more complicated than being a bystander to harassment in the workplace, being a bystander who is confided in about a very violent incident of intimate partner violence is different. And I'd love for Liz maybe to educate listeners and everyone a little bit more about what that responsibility, quote unquote, is or is not.
Liz?
Absolutely. Thank you for raising that, Alexis. So what we know from working with survivors and from the research is that trying to set limits in an abusive relationship, trying to confront the abuser, trying to leave, disclosing what has happened, all of those things can really escalate the violence and can put a survivor in mortal danger. And what we see is that the majority of domestic violence homicides occur in the context of some kind of separation or of the survivor taking action. So that means that bystanders, friends, family who are aware of an intimate partner violence situation really need to follow the victim's lead in terms of what that victim believes will be the safest course of action for them. What we advise friends and family to do is to stand by your loved one, to support and encourage them to take a non-judgmental approach, and to recognize that they are the only one that can make the call about what will be the safest and best course of action to keep themselves safe.
Alexis, I think what you said would be intriguing to a lot of people and something a lot of people hadn't thought about, the difference between hearing about a domestic abuse situation and hearing about a workplace sexual harassment situation. Can you elaborate on that a little more?
Sure. So I want to be specific. I'm talking about being a bystander in the workplace versus being somebody who a person confides in privately. So being a bystander in the workplace means that maybe you are sitting at a meeting where somebody makes a sexist joke and the only woman in the room is then under enormous pressure to react, respond, not respond, what have you. And then what do the bystanders in the room do? In this case, let's say a male bystander in the room. What is that male bystander's obligation to the other person? Or what is a coworker who sees a boss be inappropriate in some way, who witnesses that behavior do? There are options there that are pretty myriad. You can report to HR, you can go up to the person and ask them what it is I can do to help you. You can interject something. When, you know, the safety concerns that Liz just outlined simply are different. When somebody who is in a violent relationship confides privately in a friend, a person, a colleague, the priority, as Liz points out, has to be the what that person wants to do, their safety, and what's in their best interest. And I think that that is something that gets lost. And one thing I would add is that we've seen this major cultural sea change in the way media covers this. So whereas, for instance, the Post that editorialized today just, you know, years ago put a photograph of one of Vito Lopez's victims on the front page after stalking them and sensationalizing sexual harassment as some sort of sex scandal, that does not encourage people who have experienced some kind of violence or violation to come forward. And that is a problem we're seeing corrected now in this Me Too movement, but it's one worth contextualizing all of this in.
Let's take a phone call. Anne in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Liz Roberts from Safe Horizons and Alexis Grinnell, writer and political consultant. Hi, Anne.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. And this is such a great, obviously great conversation. And it's been quite a week of watching these allegations and an amazing article in The New Yorker come forward. Just from my own experience, you know, in terms of just being with someone who's a charismatic person and someone who has prominence in the community, I was with someone like this for a number of years, and I really didn't realize the level of the psychological abuse until after I was out of the relationship. And it took a long time with therapy and to really coming to terms with, you know, just how draining this relationship or these relationships can be. And I just want to say now that even to this day, this person is still part of the community, still performing. And I find sometimes that women just don't even really believe what happened to me. You know, it's like there's a lot of judgment from other women that you should take care of yourself and all your responsibility, that, you know, but I think that these things can kind of sneak up on you. And in my case, because it wasn't physical abuse, it was just the emotional undermining of who I am, you know, and that control that they want. All these people, all these abusers, all they want is control.
Liz, is this resonating?
Absolutely. And Anne, I'm so glad you called in. And what you just described is such a common experience that it's really only in retrospect that you can see the dynamics of the emotional abuse. You know, one of the things that we say often is that nobody ever slaps you on a first date. It's a gradual process where, you know, a relationship can start out really lovely. And once you're attached, once you're relying on the person, then the emotional abuse, the physical abuse, if that's the case, creeps in and escalates over time. And so you almost can't see it eroding your confidence until things become quite painful and difficult.
Yeah, and absolutely.
Thank you for sharing your story. It's helpful. And to her point about the control, there were the ways, Alexis, that Schneiderman reportedly had an interest in dominating his girlfriends, as the caller says, in addition to, or in the caller's case, not even with violence in the picture, but Schneiderman wanted to control their behavior, like keeping them eating light so they'd be really thin and having a tattoo removed, which was painful, so the woman would look presentable as the potential future wife of an attorney general, according to the New Yorker article. How does that intersect with domestic violence?
I think this idea of controlling women's moves and bodies is directly related to harming them physically. I think Liz can speak more obviously to the way in which the psychological component of domestic violence works in concert with the physical aspects of it. But that is pretty typical, I think, of this kind of pattern of behavior.
And Liz, when you talked about how nobody hits somebody on the first date and it's a creeping pattern, in the article, Schneiderman's ex-wife was quoted as saying in the course of their relationship, he never displayed any kind of violent behavior. If that's true, do you recognize that? I mean, can somebody become an abuser later in life?
You know, it's hard to know what happened there, and I don't want to speculate.
We just don't know.
Who knows? Yeah. It is certainly true that abusive behavior can increase or diminish over the course of the lifespan and that the dynamics can play out differently in different relationships.
We can move on from there.
Yeah, thank you.
Sophie in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sophie.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
That's not my real name, but I just wanted to say that I come from a household of domestic violence. My parents were physically abusive, but alcohol was always the trigger. And it feels like in this situation, that was the same thing. So perhaps maybe he didn't, I don't want to imply he had a drinking problem or anything, but maybe he didn't have one before, but maybe now that was the trigger in this situation later mm-hmm. in his life. And I just wanted them, because I think no one has brought this up as, mm-hmm. you know, as a factor in the relationship.
Totally.
Because I could, yeah, because I could see, how, yeah, I'm sorry. So I could see how, like, the women probably didn't realize he was violent. And then the first time it happened, they were like, well, he was just drinking. And, you know, made the excuse. And then it became the, it kept becoming the excuse until they realized this wasn't a, not a good situation.
Right. Thank you, Sophie. And certainly one issue, as reported, was Schneiderman's heavy drinking. Liz, what's important to know about how mm-hmm. alcohol and domestic violence tend to interact?
Yeah, I'm so glad you raised this, Sophie. Thanks for calling in. And I know, you know, witnessing violence as a child can have such lifelong repercussions. So glad you're talking about it. You know, we see a really complex relationship between intimate partner violence and substance use, whether it's alcohol or other substances. So, you know, sometimes people simplify it and they say, oh, the alcohol causes the violence. And I think it's important to stay away from that kind of simplistic look at it. Part of the dynamic that we see sometimes in abusers is that in drinking a lot, they know how they behave. When they drink, and it is in a way, it's an excuse, and it's a way they give themselves permission to behave in that way. So it is a complicated relationship. There is no doubt that when somebody has abusive tendencies and they are drinking heavily, they can be more dangerous and the abuse can be more severe. There is no doubt that somebody who has a drinking problem may behave in ways when they're drinking that they wouldn't when they were sober, but it's not a one-way causal relationship.
Right.
And I would just say, you know, many of us will go out for a few drinks, and most of us don't then turn around and try to choke our partners when we do that.
Yeah. And in Schneiderman's case, as suggested in the article, he may have been a very high-functioning, as they call it, mm-hmm. alcoholic, like drinking really a lot, and sometimes engaging in this abusive behavior at those times, but then waking up and being able to go about his life and his demanding job the next day. If that's the case, does that seem really unusual or more a sign of a common problem of, like, partially hidden alcoholism?
I actually think that's quite common. I think we're all surrounded by people who function in that way for many years, and it may not be sustainable in the very long run, but it's quite common. It doesn't mean that coworkers might not have been aware that there were times when he drank excessively, but clearly he was able to continue a very successful career at the same time.
So what do you advise people do if they're domestic abusers or Jekyll and Hyde in that way? When can they address the alcohol problem as something maybe treatable that stops the violence, or can't they ever be separated like that?
Mm-hmm. I think it's really important not to get invested in the idea that if the person just got sober, the violence would stop, because it doesn't often work that way. And so I really think of it as this person has two problems, a drinking problem and an abusive behavior problem. And in order for them to change the way they relate to me, actually both problems need to be addressed, and they have to be serious about it. And if they continue to say, well, it's just the drinking, then that's actually a problem, because it's not taking responsibility for the abusive behavior. And, you know, it sounds like from what was described in the New Yorker, the worst of the physical abuse might have happened at times when there was a lot of alcohol, but the emotional abuse was going on all the time, is the impression I got. And that's an important thing to note, that the pattern of abusive behavior extends beyond when there are substances involved.
Katie in Virginia, you're on WNYC. with Liz Roberts from Safe Horizon, an organization offering support to victims of domestic violence, and Alexis Grinnell from Pythia Public, a political and public affairs firm, and frequent contributor to the Daily News on both New York State politics and gender issues. Just resetting our guests for everybody. And Katie, thank you for calling in.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I just wanted to emphasize the reverberations throughout a person's life. I too was abused as a child, and I'm actually getting ready right now to go to therapy, which I've been in for 20 years as a result of domestic abuse by the hands of my father. He had the, or still has the ability to have the Jekyll and Hyde characteristics, where he can present one face at home and turn around and be an entirely different person in public. The police have been called to our house numerous times. I grew up in the Northeast in a very nice small town. And when the police would be called, he would just kind of yuck it up with the police and they would be fine. And even though I was a minor being abused, nothing would happen. So, it was devastating, and it still is.
Our hearts are breaking. Alexis is putting her hand to her heart. And Alexis, maybe this is in your wheelhouse a little bit as somebody who writes both about gender issues and about political power.
Yeah. I'm so glad that you called in, and I'm so glad that you are taking care of yourself. The way in which institutions fail individuals is a really, recurring pattern that's particularly disturbing, that you point out in the example of your father and the police coming and standing and doing nothing. And it makes me think a lot about something I'm seeing now that's kind of interesting to me, which is that a lot of male politicians are getting up and virtue signaling that they support a woman for AG, that we need more women, or a lot of, you know, men on social media. Attempting to do the right say something good to the effect of we need more women in public office, and until we figure out what's going on with men, like we need, you know, men need to just sit down, stop talking. But I'd really like to hear these men talking a little bit more about the institutions they lead and their individual behavior, and examining that within the context of the conversation, rather than rushing to sort of pick up political points with female voters by becoming the poster child for feminism at just the right moment when it makes the most political sense. Because what you're talking about is so incredibly upsetting and pervasive, and I think requires a lot more focus and examination. And I'd like to see people, law enforcement, et cetera, leading these relevant institutions, standing up and being like, okay, what's wrong with us? And for male politicians, frankly, not just male, but women as well, directing attention that way. Because I think this idea that replacing men with women, any women, will solve the problem is misguided. And certainly, I think Liz can speak this as well. But we know that in these kind of situations, it's more complicated than, you know, gender identity. The enablers and bystanders and people who are part of violence, or, you know, on the other spectrum, harassment, who are part of institutions, leading institutions like WNYC, where the CEO is a woman and has been under a lot of scrutiny. This is not a one-to-one ratio of let's just swap out the men, put in the women, and we'll solve this problem.
Katie, anything else you want to say? Otherwise, thank you for sharing your story and starting an important thread of the conversation.
No, I mean, I think just when people are higher up in society, I guess, like my father, I think that it's thought of more as like, oh, well, these people have the resources, they're well off, they'll take care of their own, kind of thing. But other than that, thank you so much for taking my call. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate the work you do and your show.
Thank you so much for saying that. Alexis, Governor Cuomo appointed the Nassau County DA, who happens to be a woman, I don't know if that's why, to investigate Schneiderman for possible criminal behavior towards the women or in using state resources to enable it. Cuomo took the investigation away from Manhattan DA Cy Vance, who had opened one yesterday. Do you support that?
Well, I think Cy Vance is very much conflicted out of leading this investigation, and most people would agree, since he was currently under investigation by the Attorney General for
Fi Schneiderman
for, in fact, failing to prosecute Harvey Weinstein. So, I mean, that's just a basket of snakes, and it was right for the governor to take it out of Vance's hands. I know that Vance is out with a letter strongly protesting that decision, and I do think what we're seeing here is two men really battling over the right to earn pickup points with female voters, frankly. Certainly, D.A. Singus is very qualified. I do think it's no accident that he has chosen a woman to do that. And it's not necessarily the wrong move either. I'm just suspicious of men in power virtue signaling who then don't also complement that with a real discussion about masculinity, institutions, and the way in which the structures in place that they have control over contribute to this.
You mean Cuomo in this case?
For instance, but I mean, there are, it's very popular right now to be all for women. And you know, as a feminist and somebody who writes about gender balance and who wants to absolutely see more women in elected office and positions of power, part of me says, great, this is that moment and I'm opportunistic and sure, why not? And then the other part of me says, I want more women in positions of power and in office, but not necessarily because there's an idea that they're going to solve all the problems and make and eliminate patriarchy and sexism. And I think that's too high a cliff to push us off onto. And there's a phenomenon called the glass cliff, wherein women are elevated to positions of power, frankly, after all men have failed and institutions are coming apart at the seams. We see this research originally done in the UK regarding companies, but it's since been replicated in politics and government as well. And when women hit that cliff, it's like, okay, everything else has failed. Men have failed. Everything's broken. We'll give a woman a chance. And then they're set up to fail. I don't think that's necessarily what's going on here, but I think the bias that's working in favor of women at the moment is also a bias that can cut the other way.
Where does the interim replacement process for Schneiderman stand? I know you were starting to follow that when
Sure. You
were on yesterday.
So the statute says that the legislature, when it is in session, shall appoint or someone to essentially, in the event of somebody's resignation or absence, shall appoint a replacement. There is no timetable for that. So technically, you know, the legislature can take their sweet time, although I know that, you know, everybody and their mother has indicated an interest in this job and is campaigning very aggressively, mostly behind the scenes, frankly. And, you know, whereas the legislature essentially should be interpreted as must play a role in the appointments process here, they certainly have the option, frankly, to appoint officially acting Attorney General Barbara Underwood to continue in her position. That is an option. And the problem here is with the legislature having essentially a thumb on the scale to advantage one person over the other and take it out of a competitive process that the voters have really a fair chance to weigh in on.
How much, and we were talking yesterday and a lot of other media have talked in the last day about how there are all these other political agendas coming into play with the legislature's deliberations over who's going to be the acting attorney general. The legislature, especially the assembly, which has most of the power here, is likely to want one of its own. So it's somebody who's not going to be too tough on the legislature from the position of attorney general at a time when, of course, many legislators are under scrutiny for ethics violations in recent years and things like that. There was talk about maybe wanting Tish James, a New York public advocate, to get her out of the way from the 2021 mayoral election in support of some other potential Democratic candidates for 2021, if the interim appointment of her makes it more likely that she'll get the actual election in November of this year. I mean, all these agendas going into it that are not who's going to make the best attorney general.
No, it's a horse race. And I think there's a real question about whether it should be. And I think again, there is an option to simply keep acting Attorney General Barbara Underwood, who is amazing, who graduated first in her class from Georgetown. And as you read her resume yesterday, clerked for Thurgood Marshall, has argued 20 cases before the Supreme Court, and has been the Solicitor General since 2007 and just doing her job competently. And before that, served in the Eastern District. Why not just have a person who's good at the job do the job? Taking it out of the realm of qualifications and making it a political question is, of course, what tends to infuriate voters.
As a political analyst, how much power of incumbency do you think there is? How much of an advantage of incumbency
right.
when we get to the Democratic primary in September, when presumably there's going to be a strong and hopefully diverse slate of candidates running to really be elected to the job?
So it's interesting, because here this would be a 4-month dash to the finish line. And the advantage of incumbency is not so much time, because, you know, it's not a lot of time, frankly, to make a name for yourself, even in that office. It's so short. But it's the institutional support that comes with that. So if you are the candidate of some powerful person, and that's your rabbi, and let's say the state Democratic committee is going to mobilize its support around you, that's an enormous leg up in terms of petitioning to get on the ballot, fundraising for resources, and frankly, the sort of outreach to blocks of voters like union voters, et cetera. So those are the advantages. I think what's interesting, though, is in a very crowded field that this very well could be, that's splitting the pie in a lot of different pieces. And depending upon those who those people are, some of them will knock each other out, mm-hmm. competing over the same constituencies. Mm-hmm. And the sort of Cynthia factor here should not be downplayed.
Cynthia Nixon.
Right, because we have a competitive primary in the governor's race that's getting a lot of attention, that's going to probably produce higher turnout than in a sleepy old election cycle, which means more voters who are not what are called prime Democrats, people who vote sort of religiously in every election, may turn out. And those people are not the same people typically captured by party institutions.
Fascinating. Last question for you, and then we'll wrap it up with Liz to give people an avenue to reach out if they're in a domestic abuse situation themselves. What about Schneiderman as a backstop to the Mueller investigation? Because if there are pardons or firings, some potential crimes could be prosecuted as New York crimes if they happened in Trump Tower or something. How much does it complicate that in the short term, in your opinion?
I think not at all. I think that I said this yesterday, the office is not the man and the man is not the office. And the same lawyers who got up every day and worked on those cases, who were not the attorney general, frankly, poring over the paperwork, are going to continue to do their jobs competently, like they have this entire time.
And Liz, from Safe Horizon, sadly, we could continue to take call after call, looking at a caller board from people who either were or are in domestic abuse situations. How should they reach out to your organization or anyone else for help if they're in current need and this Eric Schneiderman story is triggering something for them, or even maybe raising awareness about the situation they're in themselves?
Mm-hmm. So I would encourage anybody who is in that situation to reach out to our domestic violence hotline at 1-800-621-HOPE. Also, you could check out our website, safehorizon.org, where we have a lot of information about domestic violence and about resources, and know that you're not alone. It's estimated that 1 in 4 women and a very significant percentage of men as well in this country have experienced intimate partner violence at some point in their lives, and it often takes a story like this to really bring that to awareness for any individual survivor.
Liz Roberts, Deputy CEO at Safe Horizon, an organization offering support to victims of domestic violence, and Alexis Grinnell, co-founder of Pythia Public, a political and public affairs firm and a frequent contributor to the Daily News on both New York State politics and gender issues. Thank you both very much for joining us.